through the knowledge of him may be exalted, accordingly to what he has explained, saying, unto thee it was shown that thou mightest know, and so on. Know this day, and lay it to thy heart, and so on. And that we should devote ourselves to his worship, according to what he said, and to serve him with all your heart, and you shall serve the Lord your God, and him shall you serve. And as at that time, the way of life generally accepted and customary in the whole world, and the universal service upon which we were brought up consisted in offering various species of living beings in the temples in which images were set up, in worshipping the latter, and in burning incense before them, the pious ones and the ascetics being at that time, as we've explained, people who were devoted to the service of the temples consecrated to the stars, his wisdom may he be exalted, and his gracious ruse, which is manifest in regard to all his creatures, did not require that he give us a law prescribing the rejection, abandonment, and abolition of all these kinds of worship. For one could not then conceive the acceptance of such a law, considering the nature of man, which always likes that to which it is accustomed. At that time, this would have been similar to the appearance of a prophet in these times, who, calling upon the people to worship God, would say, God has given you a law forbidding you to pray to him, to fast, to call upon him for help and misfortune. Your worship should consist solely in meditation without any works at all. So what is the Rambam saying here? What is his true attitude towards petitionary prayer? I think that's pretty clear. There's a mashal and a nimshal here. Therefore, he, may he be exalted, suffered the above-mentioned kinds of worship to remain, but transferred them from created or imaginary and unreal things to his own name, may he be exalted, commanding us to practice them with regard to him, and may he be exalted. May he be exalted. Thus, he commanded us to build a temple for him, and let them make me a sanctuary. Have an altar for his name. An altar of the earth shall you make unto me, to have a sacrifice offered up to him. When any of you bringeth an offering to the Lord, to bow down and worship before him, and to burn incense before him. And he forbade the performance of any of these actions with a view to someone else. He who sacrificeth unto the gods, be utterly destroyed, and so on. For thou shalt bow down to no other god, and so on. And he singled out the priests for the service of the sanctuary, saying that they may minister unto me in the priest's office. And because of their employment in the temple and the sacrifice in it, it was necessary to fix them for them dues that would be sufficient for them, namely the dues of the Levites and the priests. Through this divine ruse, it came about that the memory of idolatry was effaced, and the grandest and true foundation of our belief, namely the existence and oneness of the deity, was firmly established, while at the same time the souls had no feeling of repugnance and were not repelled because of the abolition of modes of worship to which they were accustomed, and that which no other mode of worship was known at that time. I know that on thinking about this at first, your soul will necessarily have a feeling of repugnance towards this notion and will feel aggrieved because of it, and you will ask me in your heart and say to it, how is it possible that none of the commandments, prohibitions, and great actions which are very precisely set forth in these particular seasons should was it be intended for its own sake, for the sake of something else, as if this were a ruse? What was there to prevent him, may be exalted, from giving us a law in accordance with his first intention, and from procuring us the capacity of accepting it? In this way, there would have been no need for the things that you consider to be due to a second intention. Hear then the reply to your question that will put an end to the sickness in your heart and reveal to you the true reality of that which I have drawn to your attention, namely, in its dictum, God led them not by the way of the land of the Philistines, although it was near, and so on, but God led the people about by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. Just as God perplexed them in anticipation of what their bodies were naturally incapable of bearing, turning them away from the high road to which they had been going towards another road so that the first attention should be achieved, so did he, in anticipation of what the soul is naturally incapable of receiving, prescribe the laws that we have mentioned so that the first intention should be achieved, namely the apprehension of him may be exalted and the rejection of idolatry. For just as it is not in the nature of the man that, after having been brought up in slavish service, occupied with clay, bricks, and similar things, he should all of a sudden wash them off from his, or wash off from his hands the dirt rotting to them, and proceed immediately to fight against the children of Anak, so it is not in his nature that, after being brought up upon many, very, very many modes of worship and customary practices which the souls find so agreeable, that they become, as it were, a primary notion, he should abandon them all of a sudden. And just as the deity used the gracious ruse in causing them to wander perplexedly in the desert until their souls became courageous, it being well known that life in the desert and lack of comforts for the body necessarily develop courage, whereas the opposite circumstance necessarily develop cowardice, and until, moreover, the people were born who were not accustomed to humiliation and servitude, all this having brought about by Moses our master by means of divine commandments, at the commandment of the Lord they encamped, and at the commandment of the Lord they journeyed, and at the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses, so did this group of laws from a divine grace, so that they should be left with the kind of practices to which they were accustomed, and so consequently the belief which constitutes the first intention should be validated in them. So the Rambam is very, very clear. That's one of his strikingly original ideas, that the notion of inculcating true beliefs, the Torah in its entirety, can encompass some things which were necessarily a compromise to the beliefs and practices of the time. So what the Rambam means, true opinion about petitionary prayers is, I don't know, but it's clear that he has introduced this new idea that the Torah was given within the framework of a given society, and that it had to be formulated in such a way that it could develop out of the existing society, not a sudden break which the human soul was incapable of achieving.
Is the Moreh Nevuchim earlier?
Yes, that's the Moreh Nevuchim. Book 3, chapter... Couldn't find it last time. In the heart. Okay. So, I want to repeat that, on the other hand, the Rambam certainly, as we remember, doesn't have any belief in demons whatsoever. Remember that the Rambam wrote about demons and magic and so on. Udvarim ha'elu kulam divrei sheker v'kazav hein v'heim shehit'u b'hen hovdei kochavim ha'kadmonim l'goyei ha'ratzot kedei sh'yanhigu achariihem. V'elu ha'ui li'Yisrael sheheim chachamim v'chukamim l'himashech b'havalim elu v'lo ha'alahalot alev sh'yesh to'elet v'hen. She'ne'emar ki lo nachash b'yakov v'lo kesem Yisrael. V'ne'emar ki ha'goyim ha'elu ashatam yoresh otam el ma'olinim v'el kosmim yishmo'u ויתה לא חיים בגומר. וכל המאמין בדברים אלו וכיוצא בהן ומחשב בליבו שהן אמץ ודבר חכמה, אבל התורה אסרתן אינן אלא מן השכלים ומחסרי הדעת ובכלל הנשים והקטנים שאין דעתן שלמה. אבל בעלי חכמה ותמימי הדעת ידעו בראיות ברורות שכל אלו הדברים שאסרה התורה אינם דברי חכמה, אלו תוהו והבל שנמשכו בהם חסרי הדעת וניטשו כל דרכי האמת בגללה. ומפני זה אמרו התורה כשהזהירה על כל אלו הבלים תמים תהיה עם השם אלוקיה. And that's a general view on demons, on magic, and all superstitious matters. And in fact, every place where the Gemara mentions a halacha that depends or is caused by the belief in the existence of demons and so on, either the Rambam doesn't bring it at all, or offers an alternative explanation. So when the Gemara says, "Oklim u'mashkim tachat amita, afilu mukupon bechlei bazel ruach v'ashor aleihem," if you leave food under the bed, even if they're covered with a steel cover, a evil spirit hovers over them. The Rambam brings this halacha, "V'lo yiten hatatshil tachat hamita, afal pi shehasuk v'suda, shema yipol bo davar hamazik v'hu ein eruah." Maybe a piece, some dirt will fall into the pot if you leave it under the bed. The Rambam, of course, criticizes him because it says clearly that it's because of ruach ra'ah. And similarly, Rav Avraham ben Rambam writes as in the tales concerning demons, an unformed person seeing them might believe that such things existed in the world as written. He will then come to believe in an impossibility as if it required. All this will come about because of his foolishness and ignorance of nature and of miraculous works and of the method of discourse of our Savior. Similarly, the Ibn Ezra, which we read last time, was La'se'urim hem ha'shedim v'nekuruchem ba'avur shahishta'er ha'guf ha'ro'er otam. The person who sees them will have his hair stand on end. He will ba'akarov, a more reasonable reason, ba'avur shi'iru otam ha'mishugaim k'dmut ha'se'urim asher hem zonim k'kol mi shemabakesh otam u'manin behem zoneh mitachat elokam. Anyone who believes in demons. So we have three rationalists: the Rambam, the Rambam ben HaRambam, and the Ibn Ezra, none of whom believe in demons. And I waited a while because I wanted to quote the Rambam that we discussed last time. So let me read the appropriate phrase in the Rambam. The Rambam points out that God did not choose to make sudden breaks, which would be offensive to human nature, either as far as military strategy is concerned or as far as the nature of the soul is concerned. And he writes, his wisdom may be exalted, and his gracious ruse, which is manifest in regard to all his creatures, did not require that he give us a law prescribing the rejection, abandonment, and abolition of all these kinds of worship, meaning sacrifices. For one could not then conceive the acceptance of such a law, considering the nature of man, which always likes that to which he is accustomed. At that time, this would have been similar to the appearance of a prophet in these times, who, calling upon the people to worship God, would say, God has given you a law forbidding you to pray to him, to fast, to call upon him for help in a misfortune. Your worship should consist solely of meditation without any works at all. Therefore, he may be exalted, suffer the above kinds of worship to remain, but transfer them from created or imaginary and unreal things to his own name, may he be exalted. Okay, so I just quoting the Rambam specifically that we mentioned Ba'al Peh last time, because you were a little upset by it. But let's continue in this vein to understand that the Rambam did not believe in demons, even Ezra did not believe in demons, the Rambam and Ibn Ezra did not believe in demons, but Rambam introduced this very original principle that the Torah was given in a certain cultural context, and you have to keep your eye on the ball. The main eye on the ball is monotheism, and therefore God wanted to wean people away from the worship of creatures, of stars or of other objects. And since the only mode of worship known to mankind at that time consisted of sacrifices, then the sacrifices were transferred to the worship of God. That's the Rambam's position. So if this is heresy, it's not my heresy. It's explicitly the Rambam's heresy. This is not something that I'm reading into the Rambam, and it's not an interpretation. There's no possibility of, and nobody has ever interpreted the Rambam differently on that point. Now, I want to come back. Remember, I want to go back and read both the Ibn Ezra, briefly, and then another long Ramban. The Pasuk says, V'natan Aharon al shnei ha-se'irim gorolot, gorol echad la'adonai, v'gorol echad la'azazeh. And the Ibn Ezra writes, the Amar of Shmuel, Afal Pisha Katur, the Sa'ir Chatat, Shuhul Hashem, Gam Hasa'ir Hemishtaleh, Hul Hashem. Famous quote, because obviously there's some semblance of Avodah Zarah here. And he says, Ve'ein Sarich. This is not necessary, the Ibn Ezra says. Ki Hemishtaleh Einenu Korban. The Sa'ir Hemishtaleh was never sacrificed. Ki lo yishachet, ve'im yacholta lahavin hasod shehu achar milat azazel, heidah sodo, besod shmo, ki yesh lo chaverim b'mikra, ואני אגלה לך קצת הסוד והרמז בהיותך בן 33 תדן. Shall I repeat that in English?
We're all over the trip.
It's not necessary, he says, because the sa'ir that's sent away is not a sacrifice, because it's not slaughtered. And if you could understand the secret, which is after the word Azazel, you would understand its secret, and the secret of its name. Because it has similarities in the Mikra, and I will uncover a bit of the secret with a hint that when you'll be 33 years old, you will understand.
I have to be 40.
No. The Ibn Ezra is extraordinarily clear here. He's just scared to say it to a person who's not smart enough to figure out what he means. So let's see what he means, and let's see what the Ramban's take on it is. So now, I'm devoting this to you just to set your mind at ease, Mr. Weinstein. You were really very upset last week, and I want to get this all...
I didn't see anything in the encyclopedia under atonement that it would be...
I'll read it here. I have Xerox. All right, so here I'll read to you again so that I will not be accused of mistranslating the Ramban. I will read you Rabbi Chevelle's translation of the Ramban. So this will take a while. And the other Lafra Azazel. This was a high mountain, a flinty, precipitous peak, as it is said, a land which is cut off. This is the language of Rashi. And in the Terat Kohanim, the rabbis have said, for Azazel, this means the hardest place in the mountains. I might think it refers to an inhabited place. Scripture therefore says, into the wilderness. Whence do we know that it be a precipitous peak? Scripture therefore says, unto a land which is cut off. Accordingly, the meaning of the word Azazel is to a hard place. The root of the word Azazel being Az, strong, with the letter Zion doubled, just as in Izuz, strong and mighty. Now Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra wrote, said Rav Shmuel, only it is with reference to the goat of the sin offering that it's written explicitly that it was for the eternal. The goat which was sent away to Azazel was also for the eternal. But there's no need for this comment. For the goat which was sent away was not an offering, since it was not slaughtered. Now if you can understand the secret of the word after Azazel, you will know its secret, and the secret of its name, since it has companions in Scripture. And I will reveal to you part of the secret by hint. When you will be at 33, you will know. Thus far are the words of Ibn Ezra. Now, of Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, it may be said that he is that as of a faithful spirit concealeth a matter. And I will not be the talebearer who revealeth the secret, since our rabbis of blessed memory have already revealed it in many places. They have said in Bereshit Rabbah, and the Sa'ir shall carry upon him, this is a reference to Esau, as it says, behold, Esau, my brother, is a man who is Sa'ir. All of Avonotam, their iniquities, read Avonotam, the sins of him was called Tam, a man of integrity, as it is said, and Jacob was a man Tam. It is explained more clearly in the chapters of the great Rabbi Eliezer, the reason why they would give Sama'el, a conciliatory gift on the Day of Atonement, was that so he should not annul the effect of their offerings. As it is said, one lot for the eternal, and the other lot for Azazel. The lot of the Holy One, blessed be he, to be a burnt offering, and the lot of Azazel to be a goat of sin, bearing upon it all the iniquities of Israel, as it is said, and the goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities. When Samael saw that he could find no sin on the Day of Atonement amongst them, the children of Israel, he said to the Holy One, blessed be he, Master of all worlds, you have one people on earth who are comparable to the ministering angels of the heavens. Just as the ministering angels are barefooted, so are their Israelites barefooted on the Day of Atonement. Just as the ministering angels do not eat or drink, so there is no eating or drinking in Israel on the Day of Atonement. Just as the ministering angels have no joints in their feet, and therefore cannot sit or lie down, so do the Israelites stand on their feet in the Day of Atonement. Just as there is peace in the midst of ministering angels, so do the Israelites bring peace amongst themselves on the Day of Atonement. Just as the ministering angels are free from all sin, so are the Israelites free from all sin on the Day of Atonement.
and the Holy One, blessed be He, hears the testimony concerning Israel from their prosecutor, and He atones for the altar, and for the sanctuary, and for the priests, and for all the people of the assembly, as it is said, and He shall make atonement for the most holy place, etc. Thus far is the language of this Haggadah, which the rabbis have informed us of His name, Samael, and the nature of His deeds. Now this is the secret of the matter. They used to worship other gods, namely the angels bringing offerings of a sweet savor to them, similar to that which it said, and now that set mine oil and my incense before me, my bread also, etc. You have to contemplate the scriptural text as it is written, and also as it is read according to the Masoretic tradition. Now the Torah has absolutely forbidden to accept them as deities, or to worship them in any manner. However, the Holy One, blessed be He, commanded that on the Day of Atonement we should let loose a goat in the wilderness to that prince which rules over wastelands. And this goat is fitting because He is its master, and the destruction and waste emanate from that power, which in turn is the cause of the stars of the sword, wars, quarrels, wounds, plagues, divisions, and destruction. In short, it is the spirit of the sphere of Mars, and it is the portion among the nations. Its portion among the nations is Esau, Rome, the people that inherited the sword and the wars, and among the animals its portions consist of the Seirim, demons, and the goats. Also, in its portions are the devils called destroyers, in the language of our rabbis, in the language of the scripture, Seirim, Satyrs, demons, for thus he and his nation were called Seir. Now the intention in our sending away the goat to the desert was not that it should be an offering from us to it, heaven forbid. Rather, our intention should be to fulfill the wish of our Creator who commanded us to do so. This may be compared to the case of someone who makes a feast for his master, and the master commands the person making the feast, give one portion to that servant of mine. In which case, the host gives nothing of his own to the servant, and it's not to show him honor that he acts in that way to him, but everything is given to the master, and it is the master that gives a gift to the servant. The host only observes his command and does in honor of the master whatever he has commanded him to do. The master, however, out of his own compassion for the host, wanted all his servants to derive some enjoyment from it, in order that they may speak of his, the host's, praise and not of his shortcomings. This is then the reason for having someone who cast the lots on the two goats. If the priest were to dedicate them merely by word of mouth, without casting a lot, saying one for the eternal and one for Azazel, this would be like worshipping Azazel or taking a vow in its name. Rather, the priest set the two goats before the eternal at the door of the tent of the meeting, for both of them were a gift to God, and he gave to his servant that portion which came to him from God. It is he who cast the priests who cast the lots on them, but it is his hand that apportioned them, and something like that which it is said, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing of it is of the eternal. Even after the casting of the lots, the priest placed the two goats before the eternal, thus proclaiming that both his and that by sending one away to the desert, we intend merely to fulfill God's wish, as it is said, and the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be set alive before the Eternal to make atonement for him to send him away, etc. That is the reason why we do not ourselves do any act of slaughtering of that goat. And Unculus rendered the expression as one lot for the name of the Lord and the other, and one lot for Azazel, because the one was for the name of the Eternal and not for Azazel, and the second was for Azazel, but not for the name of Azazel. And this is the reason that our rabbis have interpreted, and my statutes shall you keep. These are matters against which the evil inclination raises accusations, and the idolaters likewise bring charges, such as the prohibition against wearing of clothes made of wool and linen, and the law of the red heifer, and of the goat that is sent away to Azazel. Now these idolaters have not accused us in connection with the offerings, for these are the fire offerings to the Eternal. But they do accuse us in connection with the goat that is sent away to Azazel, because they think we act as they do. Similarly, they accuse us in connection with the red heifer because it is slaughtered without the camp. But in truth, the purport therefore is analogous to the goat sent away to Azazel, which is to remove the spirit of impurity. As it is said, and also I will cause the false prophets and the unclean spirits to pass out of the land. On this basis, you will understand the reason why the person sent forth the goat to Azazel must wash his garments, as they were rendered impure, and likewise, he who burns the red heifer. And what our rabbis have mentioned concerning the requirement of the washing of the garments of these priests, of the burning of the bulls, and the he-goats who are to be holy bones outside the city. Thus, Rabbi Ibn Ezra intimated to you that you will know the secret of sending away the goat to Azazel when you reach the verse and they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices unto the Sabbaths, which is 33 words further down. That's the meaning of the 33. The word Azazel is a compound one made of two words. There are many such cases. Thus the matter is explained. Unless you pursue a further investigation from the subject to that of the separate intelligences and how the spirits are affected by the offerings and the influence upon the spirits being known through the study of necromancy, while that of a separate intelligence is known by the meaning of certain allusions to the Torah to those who understand their secrets. I cannot explain more, for I would have to close the mouths of those who claim to be wise in the study of nature, following after that Greek, who denied everything except that which could be conceived by him through the physical senses, and he and his wicked disciples were so proud as to suspect that whatever he could not conceive of through his reasoning is not true. So that's the final attack on rationalism and on science. But what he is saying is pretty shocking, namely that indeed the Sa'ir la'Azazel, and this is clearly what the Ibn Ezra is saying, has something to do with appeasing a demon or sending away the impurities from the Mikdash into the demon. So, okay, Rabban did believe in demons, the Ibn Ezra didn't believe in demons. Therefore, the only interpretation that we can have of the Ibn Ezra is that we have to say that he basically agreed with the Rambam's philosophy. Namely, that this was a common notion. The notion of impurity, of tum'ah, was a common notion in all of the cultures of the time. And therefore, the idea that you could remove the tum'ah being a cause of either some physical effects or averot, from the people and from the temple, by sending this goat out into the wilderness, which is the place of the demons, was a common practice, as the Rambam wanted to say about all sacrifices, and therefore was incorporated for that reason. It may then later have evolved into other reasons and other interpretations, but basically the Ibn Ezra and the Rambam agree as to the origin of these practices. The only place where they disagree is whether they believe in the existence of these modes. Yes, it's very important that they both be connected to one another. Furthermore, let's read from the Mishnah in the first parak of Shavuot. Okay? There's a whole discussion. I mean, the whole question is Yediyah Shavuot Shtayim Shehim Arba, Yediyah Tatumah Shtayim Shehim Arba, Yitziyot HaShabbat Shtayim Shehim Arba, Ma'ot Mika'im Shtayim Shehim Arba. And then as far as Tumah is concerned, Kol Sheyesh Bo Yediyah B'Tfilah Yediyah B'Sof Ha'alim B'Entayim Hareza Ba'Oleh B'Yorei, etc., etc. Rabbi, I'll skip to the fourth Mishnah, middle of it. Rabbi Meir Omer, Kol HaSeirim Kaparatan Shaveh Al Tum'at Mikdash V'Kadasha. All of the Seirim have the function of removing the Averot which are connected with the Tum'at of the Mikdash. Rabbi Shimon Omer Mishmol Seirim V'Al Eshkali Kadashim Mechaprim Al Ata'o Sh'achal Ata Tamei Nosif Aleihem Shal Regalim, etc., etc. And then it says Abal Amal Lahem Kulam Ba'in Lachaper Al Tum'at Mikdash V'Kadasha. ועל זדון תומת מקדש בקרשיו, סעיר הנעשה בפנים ביום הכיפורים החפים. If there is a voluntary violation of the tumah of the mikdash and the karashav, then the sa'ir ha-mishtaleach and the sa'ir that was brought to the pnim and the yom ha-kippurim ha-chafim, ve'al sha'ar ha-verot shel ha-torah, ha-kalot va-ha-chamurot, ha-zdonot va-ha-shgagot, Hoda v'lo hoda, ase v'lo tase, kritot v'mitot bedin, sa'ir ha-mishtaleach machaper.
For everyone.
Echad Yisraelim v'echad Kohanim v'echad Kohen Mashiach. Ma ben Yisraelim v'Kohanim v'l'Kohen ha-Mashiach, ela shadam ha-par machaper al ha-Kohanim al tumat mikdash v'kadasha. Right. Rabbi Shimon omer k'shem shadam ha-sa'ir ha-naseh b'fnim machaper al Yisrael, kach dam ha-par machaper al ha-Kohanim. כשם שבידויו של שעיר המשתלח מחפר על ישראל, כך בידויו של פר מחפר על הכהנים. So the notion that the removal of the problem of the tum'ah in the mikdash is associated, on the one hand, with averot, and on the other hand, with the sa'ir, both the sa'ir that's brought as a karban and the sa'ir mishtaleach, is clearly asserted here in the Mishnah. And now, perhaps it's worthwhile that I actually read this article that you can find in the in the Encyclopedia Judaica.
You got the good one. I got the modern one.
This is the modern one.
The new one.
It should be three pages altogether.
And what we're saying now, along, can we say that generally about Kabbalah?
That's what the
why,
three pages.
Why just the Sayyir and the Kabbalah?
You say it generally about all Kabbalahs. Okay.
So generally for the Kabbalah.
That's what the Rambam says. All of the Kabbalahs are a compromise, a ruse, as the Rambam put it, that God made. But I want to concentrate on this issue.
The Rebbe mentioned the Seir course this week. We know it's not the
because I wanted to.
So one difference to make is it's not or it isn't. It's still under the classification of the rest of the Kabbalah.
Right, but I want to get the connection with the demons.
Oh.
That was our topic that we got into this by the back door. But I think it's an important enough principle that we.
Three pages
altogether. Oh. Day of Atonement as an annual day of purgation in temple times. Okay? The Day of Atonement was an annual day of purgation. The key to the meaning of the purgation is the realization that one, the sacrifices are of one type called chatat, purification offering, actually designated as kapata kikurim, and the three chatat animals that are employed are offered on behalf of two different groups. The bull is for the priesthood, and the two goats are for the people. According to the Mishnah, all the goats make atonement for the impurity of the temple and its sanctum. For the impurity that befalls the temple and sancta through wantonness, atonement is made by the goat whose blood is sprinkled within the shrine of the Holy of Holies, and by the Day of Atonement. For all other transgressions specified in the Torah, minor or grave, wanton or inadvertent, conscious or unconscious, of commission or omission, the scapegoat makes the atonement. The atonement is alike for the Israelites, priests, or the anointed high priest. The bull, the blood of the bull makes atonement for the impurity of the temple and its sanctum. That's what we just read in the Mishnayot and in the Masechet Shuah. Despite the expansion and reinterpretation of the ritual of the Day of Atonement in the Second Temple period, the Mishnah is a reliable guide to the interpretation of the biblical account of the ritual because the function of the sacrifice never changed. This Mishnah shows that an objective of the slain chatat animals was to purge the sanctuary of its impurity, and that the function of the live chatat goat, the one that was dispatched to Azazel, was to purge the people of their sins. This distinction is corroborated by the biblical text expressly declaring that the purpose of the slain bull and goat is to purge the shrine of its impurities, mikumot bnei Yisrael, right, and transgression, and that of the scapegoat is to carry out all their iniquities, avonot, and transgressions. The Hebrew word pesha'im, which appears twice in this context, is found nowhere else in the entire priestly code. It has been suggested that this word has been borrowed from the world of politics, where the word pesha means to rebel, and its application to the ritual of the Day of Atonement would point to a further basic function of the prescribed chatat offerings, alluded to by the Mishnah, to purge the temple and the people of their pesha'im, the rebellious sins. The priestly temple theology. The purpose of the purification of the Day of Atonement could then only be understood in conjunction with two complementary postulates. Whoever brazenly rebels against God is not eligible for the sacrificial expiation, but the temple must be purged of his sins and impurities. Moreover, the purging is urgent since his sins committed wantonly poses the additional power not only of contaminating the outer altar, but of breaching the sanctuary and penetrating to the very shrine. Thus, on the Day of Atonement, the entire temple complex must be purged. Two, the private purification offering is presented for the shgagah, the inadvertent sin, and pasir physical impurity stemming from natural causes, the temple and Azazel. A third implication of the above Mishnah is that the two categories of purification offering, the slain, whose blood purges the tabernacle, and the live, which expiates the people's sins, are two inseparable parts of a unified ceremonial. That's what Dr. Kahan explains. That this unity is not an anachronistic retrojection of rabbinic Judaism, but is a verifiable biblical reality is confirmed by the coexistence of the two categories within the same ritual in both an ancient Near East and in another biblical literature, which will be described below. Temple purifications dominate the cultic landscape of Israel's environment. this is what the Rambam was telling us, but now been verified by archaeology. The ancient pagans feared impurity because they imputed to it demonic power. This is what the Ibn Ezra is telling us. Impurity was an unending threat to the gods themselves and to their temples, as revealed by the images of the protector gods, the Shedu and the Lamassu in Mesopotamia. That's the Shedu is certainly cognate to our shade. And the lion gargoyles in Egypt, set before the entrances of temples and palaces, and above all by the elaborate purgation rituals to rid the buildings of demons and prevent their return. Examples from Pritchard, Egyptian, Hittite, etc. This, you know, this is the famous two volumes of Pritchard, which has to bring the parallel to the Bible in the various archaeological texts. Right. Okay. The antiquity and ubiquity of the Azazel rite are even more striking. However, it has apparently not been observed that two rites usually go together. Since impurity was demonic, its exorcism was not enough. Its power had to be removed. This was accomplished in one of three ways: curse, destruction, or banishment. The last was often used. Rather than the evil being annihilated by curse or fire, it was banished to its place of origin, e.g. the netherworld or the wilderness. That's what the Ibn Ezra hinted at when he said that if you understand the word that follows Azazel, namely Bamidbar, you would understand the meaning here. Or to some place where either its malefic powers could work in the interests of the sender, enemy territory, or where it could do no harm at all, mountains and the wilderness. Thus the scapegoat was sent to the wilderness, which was considered uninhabited except by the satyr demons Azazel. A parallel example of this banishment is found in the famous New Year festival in Babylonian ritual. In these cases, there's an integral connection between the actual purging by aspersion, smearing, and incense, and the transfer of the released impurity onto a decapitated ram and its banishment via the river. Similar motifs common to Babylonian and biblical purification texts indicate that the purgation expulsion nexus essential to pagan magic could have been obtained early in Israel's cult as well, but with a different meaning. Second purpose, purging the people. Though the purgation and Azazel rites of Israel's Day of Atonement differed little from their Near Eastern analogues, their meaning underwent a revolution. As scholars have noted, the rites are discrete. The slain chatat animal sufficed to purge the tabernacle, but the live chatat carries off the sins of the people. The reasons are clear. Israel, the holy people, needs the same purification as the holy place, for they shall not contaminate their camp in whose midst I dwell. Moreover, the monotheistic dynamic is at work here. Since the world of demons is non-existent for Israel, the only source of rebellion against God is in the heart of man, and it is there that cathartic renewal must constantly take place. The Azazel ritual stipulates, etc., etc.
Who's saying that, the last part?
This is by Milburg. I guess this is all by Milburg, right?
The author of this particular article.
The only source of rebellion against God is in the heart of man.
Oh, in other words, what he is saying is this. The Kiddush is very great. What he is saying is that there was a magical practice, namely the relief of sin and impurity by the sending of the scapegoat and the sacrificing of the Sayer Bithnim. Originally, this had for the cultures surrounding Israel the meaning of doing either doing something to propitiate the demon, as the Ramban says, or driving them out. But we don't believe in demons. That is, according to the Rambam, the true monotheism rejects demons, and therefore, although the ritual wasn't changed, its meaning underwent an entirely different reinterpretation. Yes. So what he is saying is that there existed this complicated set of rituals which was common to all cultures of the time, and whose original source was in demonology and the relationship between the spirit of impurity of Tum'ah and the demons themselves. And that's what the Ibn Ezra tells us. But since demons don't exist, in fact, this same series of practices was given a reinterpretation and an elevation to the extent that the only place where there is such a thing as a state of impurity is in the heart of man himself, and therefore the purification from the sins of the community are just as important in the Israel cult as the purification of the temple. So that whereas in the other cultures both the Sa'ir HaMishtaleach and the Sa'ir B'Fnim were to purify the temple, in our version of it, in the version that the Torah has of it, the Sa'ir HaMishtaleach is to atone for the sins of men. We don't know. I mean, it means just a wilderness. It's a generic term, not a specific term. In the Mishnah, in the Masechet Yuma, it describes what this was at the time of the end of the Second Temple. Okay.
Doesn't bother me so much. So what's the problem then altogether with regard to sacrifices? We feel it's like have vidoys beforehand and such a fillet, so forth. Why not? Well, what is so objectionable to the return of sacrifice? If it's only mostly symbolic and the clearing of the heart and making it all such a nice.
Well, you speak to the Rambam about that. I don't want to get into this debate. I personally would find it objectionable if, for example, next week we would reinstitute animal sacrifice.
Why not shechita generally?
Well, if you want to go further than me and be a vegetarian, that's your prerogative. But in any event, this is. I don't want to get into this. What I want to say is that first of all, the Rambam has introduced a very important principle, namely that the Torah was given within a certain cultural milieu, and that therefore, secondly, that the course of human nature is such that you can't change people's habits of mind suddenly. And the first thing has definitely been borne out by all the recent archaeological evidence. And the second item is maybe open to dispute. In our own times, we've seen such violent changes in mores and in the way people think that I'm not so sure that people's mentality, at least with modern television and other forms of communication, can't be changed much more radically and fast than what the Rambam maintains, but that's his view. So that therefore what I spent the last hour doing, more or less, Mr. Weinstein, is hope to set your mind at ease on the things that were troubling you last week. That, you know, whatever is said in this article is basically no different than the combination of what the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra said. So it's not some radical new principle. It may have been a radical new idea in the 12th century, but it's not a radical new idea today. On the other hand, what's somewhat disturbing is that the Ramban, on the other hand, actually believes in the existence of demons. And the rationalist position, namely the non-existence of demons, has always been more or less a minority position, not the majority position.
Again, this is the same at times where, you know, the people at that time.
What is that time? When did that time come to an end?
I mean, it may not have come to an end.
Okay.
No, but the Ramban's time, all right, no, that popular belief was.
If the Rambam could stand up and say, I don't believe, the Rambam could as well if he didn't believe.
Even the same era, but they were talking about
before
that.
Okay. We did this before, and Helen, you'll forgive me, but let's go through a rapid review of how this belief or lack of belief went from their time down to our time. Remember, the third great rationalist amongst the Rishonim was the Meiri.
But Kama Makama
Ola. Just for a moment. We were talking about how we're much higher at our standards, as our moral standards.
Did I say that? I didn't say anything about moral standards.
Like when reform movement came into being, they thought they did such a tremendous, well, they had a tremendous advance. They said, let's not use, like the saying, we were taught that we should return to Kabbana and so forth. They thought they were doing a tremendous advance to ethics, to our thrila and so forth. What makes us feel that that was an advance? Did I say it was an advance? Did I say to change the davening? Does the Rambam say to change the davening? He says, moreover, the monotheistic dynamic of the work and so forth and so on, but the heart is what really being purified and so forth and so on. And it's sort of like it's eliminating the expression, the act of the Seir.
No, he's saying something completely the opposite of that. What he is saying
on Kippur is like almost going back to
What he's saying, what Mr. Milgram is saying on this particular issue is exactly the opposite. But he's saying the opposite of what you're attributing to him. What he is saying is that originally both the notion